Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith taking shape at Central UMC in Sacramento, California.
The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
Thanks for listening.
Reading this morning comes to us from the Gospel of Luke. It's the first chapter, and I'm starting at verse 26. In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent by God to a town in Galilee called Nazareth, to a virgin engaged to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David. The virgin's name was Mary. And he came to her and said, "Greetings, favored one, the Lord is with you." But she was much perplexed by his words and pondered what sort of greeting this might be. The angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And now you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you will name him Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. And the Lord God will give to him the throne of his ancestor David. He will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." Mary said to the angel, "How can this be, since I am a virgin?" The angel said to her, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, the child to be born will be holy. He will be called Son of God. For nothing will be impossible with God." And then Mary said, "Here I am, the servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word." And then the angel departed from her.
In this worship series of Casting Christmas, and actually, to be very transparent, Matt and I really did talk about, I should do Joseph, he should do Mary, right? And then about 10 days ago, I'm like, no, I want to do Mary. But maybe this will be the last time. Our focus is on a different character each week, and we heard about John the Baptist last week, and we're going to do this week by week and move towards our Christmas Eve service. And the name of that night we're going to call an imperfect Christmas pageant. We already know who we are as God's people, so an imperfect Christmas pageant. And that gives us a hint about the people that God calls and works with. We're excited to explore the depths and the textures of the Christmas story, and now all of y'all have already torn off the invitation, and we're just really hopeful that you'll find a way to give one of those away each week, so that our gathering will not just be about our story and the Christmas story, but it'll be told for others who may not normally choose to put themselves in a community to hear it. So I've given you a hint. We've said today is Mary. In theater language, Mary is the lead. So we're taking on a lead role this week. The lead is the person everyone looks forward to seeing for the most part in a play or in a film, right? It's the person who sells the tickets. So if you have a strong lead, then sometimes a movie sells itself. It can be a disappointment, you know. There was that one bad movie Richard Gere did one time. I don't know. But I was still there. I didn't care. The person who plays the lead in that role carries very often not just the story, But the mode and the mood and all that we come to learn, whether it's about a situation, whether it's about a family, whether it's about a tragedy, the lead character tells us a great deal. And so today, in the role of Mary, just from what we sort of surface know of her, who might play the role in 2011? I'm thinking Selena Gomez. She could step right in that role, I think. Vanessa Hudgens, actually, she's aging a little bit, getting a little harder in life, so she may be past the prime for that role. Emma Roberts, you know, that's Julia's niece. Julia's way too old. Meryl's done. You know, Meryl's Elizabeth by now. Sorry, Meryl, I love you. But Emma Roberts might be playing the role of Mary. Or maybe Frida Pinto. She was that fabulous actress in Slumdog Millionaire. You know? Our younger women that could play this lead. The real actress, though, that came to my mind, I couldn't help it. All week I kept trying to put, was Ellen Page. Remember her? That was that movie, Juno. Teenage mom, Ellen Page. None of us actually knew there were her, of her. There were big name actors, but she played the lead in that, and she did well. Now, next Sunday we'll go back to a supporting role, but in order to know how to support in a story, you have to know a lot about the lead. So in order to help us get into this character of Mary, we're going to begin with some images. And before Harrison shows us those, I want to say something about the image of Mary in art as it's portrayed, because it has a name. You know, it's just not like Mary, Mother of Jesus. The name is the Annunciation. So paintings or icons, depictions of Mary with this part of the story in the Bible, that scene is called, referred to as the Annunciation, which simply means the announcement. It's a fancy church word for God's making an announcement. And it wouldn't be that scary of a word, actually, you know, for anyone, except that in the line of Christianity and Christian mysteries, it's one of those words that you hear as part of how we do things. So there's other words like transfiguration, right? And incarnation and resurrection. So it's one of those words which gives us a bit of a signal about this role. That even though the word itself just means announcement, it's an announcement from God. And it's an announcement from God about a mystery. So that tells us something, first of all, about these images. To further our understanding of how an announcement might come, what you're going to really see is, in this case, to Mary, it's through an angel. An angel. And an angel might be received at that time of the writing of Luke's gospel in a very interesting way, because I learned this week, I didn't know this actually, there's another book in the Apocrypha of the Bible called Tobit, and there was a popular folktale going on at the time that everyone would have known about who was hearing this. And the folktale went something like this, that if a young girl was about to get married, there was a jealous angel who didn't want her to get married. And so this jealous angel would come on the bride's wedding night and kill the groom. This was a folktale that was going on. And so, if you were a teenage girl who was betrothed and about to get married and an angel came in your room, you might go, I thought that was just a story. Right? But it permeated the culture of the time. So against that popular backdrop of knowing that that story would most likely be in Mary's consciousness, in the same way we might know what the top 10 songs on a radio are. Does that make sense? It would just be there with her. We have an appearance of an angel. So let's look at our first one, Harrison. This is the oldest. It's another icon from the Russian Orthodox Church. Icons come from the tradition of, And they're actually not paintings, or they're not considered paintings. They're mostly etched onto wood and considered a craft as opposed to a fine art. And the main feature that you see about this, I think, is the halo around each figure, which gives us a signal that they are important figures. So we have an angel on the left, Mary on the right. This icon you see might be this big. They're small. They were made to be carried or encased in beautifully tooled silver. It's not a huge painting. And that's one of the oldest icons. In iconography, I think that's right, Mary is one of the most popular figures, more popular than Jesus, actually. And she was considered more holy than Jesus because she is the bearer of God. That was interesting to learn. But there are many, many more images of Mary and all of the different announcements that come in her life in Russian iconography. Let's look at the next one, Harrison. This is a painting by Leonardo da Vinci and Andrea del Verrocchio. I don't know. That's Mary on the right, Gabriel, angel on the left. It's a little hard to see, but the angel is holding a Madonna lily, which is a white lily. It's also the namesake lily of Florence, Italy. And that told those who saw this that she was supposedly a virgin. So a Madonna lily in a painting told the viewer that something virginal was happening in the scene. Interesting thing that I learned this week about this painting, actually, though, was that it was another joint painting. Although these two artists knew, they were both studying art. It's one of Da Vinci's earliest works. And the way the story is that Verrocchio painted the angel and left a note for Da Vinci. It said, "Fill in the background, finish the angel, do some work on Mary." And the reason they know that is the first guy's paint is totally different than Da Vinci's paint. And they do this with all this lead, knowledge about lead now. And Da Vinci painted with paint that had no lead in it. So this, most people think, is just by Da Vinci. It's one of his earliest. Now we're going to really shift gears and look at one of Matt's favorite artists, Daniel Bonnell. He's a 20th century artist. Something interesting about Daniel Bonnell, I think, is that he worked under Ansel Adams and a designer, famous guy named Milton Glaser. But he was trained as a sacred artist under a Dominican monk named Pere Coutier, who's very well known. He also trained Henri Matisse. And so Bonnell's work really took a shift in that to many sacred scenes, and this is called the Annunciation. Bonnell has lived a life of intentional poverty many times. He'll go for years and live with homeless community 2 years in New York City. He lived for years in Africa and charted 12 different, very isolated, poor, disconnected communities of people. And then he would come out of that and paint and draw. One of the places he talks about as the most high risk that he lived and worked, though, was with high school teenagers in Savannah, Georgia, which is what he talks about before he painted Mary. So those are some images, just three. Maybe you have your own picture of Mary. One thing I know for sure, that when we talk about Mary, somehow everyone says blue. Yeah, blue. I really couldn't find any that where she was wearing blue, but that's my memory of every church pageant I've ever been in. Mary has on blue. So now I'm going to move us a little bit to how she might speak. What's the dialect of Mary like? Well, we know one thing from at least this passage, and I'm really just working with this passage. Method actors really would, I hope, have fun, because she hardly says anything in this. She really says very little, but what she does say is significant. We'll quickly learn that she listens. She receives long before any words come out of her mouth. So there's Mary, and an angel speaks. And so part of taking on this role, if you were to be the lead of Mary, is I think you have to have a dialect that you embody physically. And I confess, I watch soap operas. All my children's gone, my life. Oh. But we make fun of soap operas, right? But here's the deal in this passage. Angel comes in. You know the camera goes. She has to go. Right? There's that beat. There's no word. But if she's going like this, she's not expressing much. An angel comes and speaks to you. Whoever has this lead role needs to have an expressive body, manner, and face before they speak. And pretty much she says this, "Here I am." Those are really her main lines. "I'm perplexed. How can this be? Here I am." Those are the lines of a lead in this story. It's not the first time you hear, "Here I am," if you're learning biblical stories. Abraham gives this answer to God three different times. Twice when God is asking Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac, and one last time when he's just about to do it and then steps back from that. Esau says, "Here I am," when his dad calls him in to talk about his inheritance. Jacob says, "Here I am," when God comes to him in a dream. We talked about that a month or so ago. And says, "Go to Egypt. Here I am." Moses, when he's walking along, minding his business, and comes upon a burning bush, he says, what's the line? "Here I am." That's the line of a lead. Move into the New Testament, we have the prodigal son. He has taken his journey, he has gone on his trips, he has squandered his inheritance, and as he comes to himself, right before he turns towards home, it says that he says, "Here I am, dying of hunger. Here I am." And Jesus speaks to his disciples in John and says, "I came from God, and now here I am." It's the basic dialect of a lead character in any true biblical drama. Here I am signifies I'm all in, or I'm as in as I think I will ever be, or I'm as in as I think I can be at this moment when you've just scared the out of me and entered into my life, which may mean I'm ready, I'm willing. Here I am does not mean I totally have it all figured out, I'm doubt-free, yes, I know exactly what's coming next. The lines of this lead character, here I am, really also convey uncertainty, absence of knowing what the heck they might really be agreeing to other than saying yes in that moment. So we have some visual ideas of Mary, and we know what the dialect and the main line is, but who is Mary? Who is Mary? Now, for some of this, it's going to be easier than others. Maybe you really have a clear understanding of what we call Marian theology. Most Protestants don't. If you were raised Catholic, you've got it all over on us. Really. Because the Catholic Church has done a lot of work on Mary, and we not so much. So let's take a step back a little bit and look at how her main character functions in this story. I'm not going to do a whole historic sketch of her. I'm just going to look at her in this story. She's a young woman teenager. We know that. She's betrothed and she's a virgin. So I'm going to look at that first part, teenager. A lot of people make a big deal out of that. Not so much. It's the common age of the time to leave one's family and get married. That's it. It's so hard to get out of our own life to say, a teenager birthing God? What 14-year-old's ready to do all that? But in that day, it's totally. That is the time. So teenager and betrothal, those kind of come together. And betrothal is a really old concept for most of us. According to the ancient custom, betrothals were legal and they were binding. And it meant that two families had gotten together and arranged for a young male and a young female to be married. And usually there was a reason for that, land or property. There were relationships, there were kingdoms, there were all kinds of reasons, political, strategic, familial, to create a betrothal. But you didn't really have a choice, male or female, for that matter. And a girl would be betrothed and then live at home for the year of her betrothal as she got ready to be married. And the groom would then come and take her to his home at the end of that year. And the wedding would last for about a week, an entire week. And in this case, Mary's betrothed to Joseph, and the importance in some ways, although Matt will talk more about that next week, is that that means, remember we talked about the genealogy at the beginning of Mark, that she's betrothed to Joseph puts Jesus in a certain line that would be important. And that line is the line of David. So this connects her, this betrothal, to Joseph, to the line of a king, but also legally, the marriage was sealed at the time of the betrothal. So it makes my feminist back get up. But if something happened to Joseph any time during that year, she'd be considered a widow for the rest of her life. That's hard. But that's true. A betrothal was a legal arrangement taken very seriously. So she's a teenager, and she's betrothed, and there's that next big question. She was a virgin. That's a big question for lots of us, which I'm not going to try and explain away. I'm really not. What I will say is that there are so many times when things don't make any kind of temporal sense in the story of how God moves and works in this world and through each of us, many of whom are in this room, because I've heard some of your stories. Many of those times leave many of us speechless and wondering, how can this be, right? So in our day and age, when we have profound skepticism and we really pretty much mistrust much of the traditions we've received, which is for good reason, I'm not going to try and explain this part away. What I will say, at the risk of losing some credibility for all the advanced degrees that are in this room, of which there are many, I'll say this. We don't know everything. We're smart, but we don't know everything. And often we have a failure of imagination that, while making us feel really comfortable and knowledgeable and understanding of everything, it doesn't challenge us very much or push us or cause us to wonder from a place of not really knowing what the right answer is. So when many artists and poets have been and are still willing to ask, how can this be? I mean, why would Daniel Bunnell in the 20th century still be asking that? Maybe the truth of how a virgin might conceive is really something we need to think about. Talking to those of us who have ever carried a child in their womb, it's not something that anyone can explain to you. I mean, I know people can explain it. First this happens, and then if everything goes right, this happens, and then everything grows. All right, but that doesn't explain that first letter thing where you go, what was that, right? Talking to those who have ever lost control over your destiny in your life that you had planned out so well, as in suddenly you're unemployed. How can this be? That feeling. Or suddenly talking to those who are employed in an area they never thought that they would go into, ever. And there they are, responsible for all this. How can this be? Right? Talking to those who have been going along fine in their lives when, wham, there's suddenly a lump. A mass, a time of waiting for test results. You're facing something that completely consumes you. How can this be? 5 seconds ago, I was a different person. How can this be? So, teenager, betrothed, a how can this be sort of a virgin? Having said all that, I want you to notice one thing. None of these qualities, these descriptions, the dialect, none of these qualities is ever really offered in the biblical account as the actual reason that God chose Mary. None of them, really. I mean, we put that on there, but it's not saying, go find a teenage virgin. It's not in there. It's nowhere I could find, anyway. God chose Mary as a lead role for reasons that maybe just lie tucked away about how God works and what God's purposes are. It's maybe in the actor's notes, you know. God chooses whom God chooses for different reasons, most of which we can only wonder and guess about. But her response is the biggest clue. Here I am. And her delivery, I don't know how you hear that, here I am. When she steps into the role and realizes this request has been made, I don't know how you hear that. I don't actually, no offense to Anthony, but I don't imagine trumpets, bum, 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 bum. I really don't. I, Vanessa, hear a bass drum going, dun, dun, dun. You know that. I think of Jaws. I do, because of that change. Da-dum. But here I am. It's a simple three words. This lead requires us to learn. So, I don't know, does anyone in here want to try out for the part? Are you too old? I don't know. Elizabeth was right before this. Maybe part of even contemplating whether you want to try out for a lead in one of God's drama means that, first of all, before you do anything, you need to notice some of the nuances of your own deepest desires. What are your own deepest desires? And how are you willing to live into those and be ready if God calls you into a lead role? Because it really could happen to any one of us at any time. When the announcement comes in your life, what are you doing right now to prepare yourself to say, here I am. Here I am. I usually go to poets or musicians to help me when I get faced with hard questions like this. And there's a poem by James Wright. It's called Trouble. I'm not going to read the whole thing. There's just three lines. And this poem is about a pregnant teenage Milltown girl who is so overshadowed. There's that line, the Holy Spirit will come upon you. There's an overshadowing. She is so overshadowed by being pregnant for her very first time, and she's caught in something that's bigger than herself. And this is how Wright puts it in poetry. 16 years, and all that time she thought she was nothing but skin and bones. When you think about yourself and God announcing God's self as ready to put you in a lead role, what do you see in yourself? Are you skin and bones? Or are you a young person who could be pregnant with possibilities? Are you a human being who wants to give birth to something new? It happens with God. We think one way about ourselves, and God sees us completely differently. Not as just empty skin and bones, but as beloved. And when we get in touch with that, if we ever do, if we get a taste of it, if we ever can, might that taste or that new discovery, the experience of becoming a radically new human being, having a new sense of ourselves, is that a form of a virgin birth? I don't know. God said, greetings, favored one. How are you doing? I'm going to ask you to hang a hard right at this virgin birth thing. How badly do we want the part? That's another question for us to ask ourselves today. How badly do we want to be in the lead with God? Theologian Karl Rahner says it like this: if God's incomprehensibility does not grip us in a word, if it does not draw us into God's superluminous darkness, if it does not call us out of that little house of our homely, closed, hugged, tight little box of truth, we have misunderstood the words of Christianity. One last thing, and it's poetry again. For the power of poetry often comes much deeper for a person, at least me, who's studying for a role. Sometimes scripture really can give you all you need, but sometimes you need music, sometimes you need art, sometimes you need poetry to help prepare you for the role. And this is a poem called The Annunciation again. And I'd like you to just listen for the sense of the intensity of the encounter, especially given how you know now there are very few words from Mary, between Mary and this angel. And listen for the sense of their meeting each other. And that moment when God comes, it goes like this. The angel and the girl are met. Earth was the only meeting place. For the embodied never yet traveled beyond the shore of space. The eternal spirits in freedom go. See, they have come together. See, while the destroying minutes flow, each reflects the other's face. Till heaven in hers and earth in his shine steady there. He's come to her from far beyond the farthest star, feathered through time. Immediacy of strangest strangeness is the bliss that from their limbs all movement takes. Yet the increasing rapture brings so great a wonder that it makes each feather tremble on angels' wings. And outside the window, footsteps fall into the ordinary day, and with the sun along the wall, pursue their unreturning way. Sound's perpetual roundabout rolls its numbered octaves out and hoarsely grinds its battered tune. But through the endless afternoon, these neither speak nor movement make, but stare into their deepening trance as if their gaze would never break. How does God's announcement come? As a word? As a feeling? As a physical encounter? How will you prepare for this role? It's a mystery. But then just think about already the greatest roles you've already played in your life. Did you really have them all figured out before you said, "Here I am"? Really?